This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. At this point, everyone says New Hampshire can't arrest its way out of the state's opioid epidemic and that much wider access to addiction treatment is needed. That said, law enforcement is definitely part of the picture, but there's debate over the ultimate effectiveness of drug sweeps and tougher sentences. For example, given that those who sell drugs are often addicted themselves, how much does the threat of heavy jail time make them think twice? Does time behind bars really help cure addiction? On the other hand, what about the hope that more dealers in jail means fewer on the streets? And if a death occurs from overdose, what kind of justice should there be for the deceased and their families? Tough questions about the role of punishment in stemming an addiction crisis today in The Exchange, so let's get you involved. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are David Rothstein. He's an attorney with the New Hampshire Public Defender. And David, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Attorney General Joe Foster. He's going to step down from the AG's office at the end of the month. And at the end of his four-year term, and Attorney General Foster, nice to see you. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, John Thomas, Lieutenant with the Concord Police Department. He's currently in charge of the Community Services Division. And Lieutenant Thomas, good to see you too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, Dean Lemire. He's active in statewide prevention, treatment, and recovery efforts, and is himself in recovery from heroin addiction. And Dean, it's always great to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
I want to start with you, Dean, actually. Does this possibility of a severe penalty stop somebody from taking drugs or selling drugs to someone else? What do you think?
I don't know that there's any data to suggest that it does make a positive effect on the problem on whole at all. I actually don't think there's data to support that. On an individual level, perhaps, you know, on somebody who's just strictly selling the product, taking it over, over borders, perhaps you've taken one person kind of off the street for a while, but on whole, there is no data to support that higher minimum sentences could kind of reverse the crisis that we're in.
I want to pick up on something you said because I think it's important. Someone who's strictly selling, are you implying there, Dean, that a lot of people who sell are also using and struggling with substance use disorders themselves?
Well, I would say most. In New Hampshire, yes. I don't think that there's a lot of people just setting up shop here. I suspect there are who are just strictly selling. Most of the people are day trippers. Maybe going down to Massachusetts to buy quantities of heroin or cocaine to come and sell up here to support their own habit. Sometimes it's much less formal. A lot of people who use drugs, illicit drugs, have jobs, actually the majority.
Regular day jobs.
Right.
What do you think, Attorney General Foster, given that many who sell drugs or give drugs to others are addicted to those substances themselves, how much do you really think that they are thinking this through, that, you know, I'm in the throes of a really tough addiction, but gosh, that tougher sentence is going to make me stop?
You know, it's hard to know. I think there's a role for law enforcement. As I talk about this issue, there's two sides. There's the supply side and the demand side. Law enforcement's really looking on the supply side of things. We do hear there are folks who certainly are selling to support their habit. There also are people who are selling because it's their business of choice. As was just mentioned, some addicts have day jobs. They're buying and they're going to work every day. Others decide to earn their living by selling drugs. And there are folks who are not do not have a substance use disorder who, in fact, sell drugs. So there's all level of dealers, and obviously there's much larger ones who basically have an entire criminal enterprise. We hear from law enforcement, the DEA, and others that some of our efforts around death-resulting cases are actually causing deterrence.
Death-resulting, just explain real quick what that is.
That's an instance where an individual sells a drug or gives a drug to another individual. The individual takes that drug and they die. That's a special statute that's been in the books for many, many years. When I saw what was happening really from fentanyl, which is effectively poison fentanyl, we hear about the heroin epidemic in New Hampshire. We don't have a heroin epidemic anymore. Of the almost 500 deaths we had last year, I think less than 10 were heroin only, but fentanyl was part of the supermajority of the deaths. And fentanyl is about 50 times stronger than heroin. 3 or 4 grains of salt-sized fentanyl can actually cause a death. You're effectively selling poison. I made the decision that we ought to relook at utilization of that statute and
the death-resulting statute,
and looking at overdoses as crime scenes and investigating them fully and trying to determine who sold the drugs. If there's an ability to make a charge, we'll make a charge. And if there isn't, there's still valuable data that's gathered to look at dealers.
What do you think, David Rothstein, about this idea of, you know, the role of law enforcement, supply and demand, and whether we're getting it right here in New Hampshire?
Sure. I agree with basically everything that's been said. There is a role of law enforcement that's undeniable. We're talking about drugs that are illegal drugs, and law enforcement has a role in enforcing the laws that are on the books. I also there are a couple comments. First of all, Dean, you asked Dean about whether we can arrest our way out of this and whether truly, the threat of arrest and punishment is going to deter. I think that if you are truly addicted to heroin and fentanyl, it's very hard to say that you're going to be deterred. There's a story in the Union Leader today. I don't know if you saw it, but the story was a couple of women in Concord. One woman was going into labor, and before she went to the hospital, she wanted to be injected with heroin, and she was. And that type of behavior is, to me, so irrational. It's more like mental illness.
It shows you how strong that addiction is.
It shows you how strong. And you know, that I know nothing about this case, and I'm not meaning to comment on the merits of the case at all. But this is a woman who we are putting into the criminal justice system and could be treated as a felon and branded a felon. I guess I would question whether she should be treated more like somebody who's mentally ill. In terms of the death resulting cases, Attorney General Foster has spoken about the upstep in prosecution. I've been doing this for about 25 years. The increase in prosecution is amazing. In the last year, the public defender has opened 14 death-resulting cases. And because of the stakes involved in these cases, because they carry a sentence of up to life in prison, because of the complexity of the cases, we treat them like homicides. So,
I mean, someone did die. So
someone
in a way,
did die.
It's kind of like a homicide. If
True.
You gave my son or daughter
Absolutely.
The illegal drug, I would consider
Right.
you the murderer.
Right. But the... We are, I think on our end, we are getting an amazing number of these cases. I think in my entire career, I don't remember seeing 14 of these types of cases for a couple of reasons. First of all, because heroin has only suddenly become the drug of choice, and heroin can kill. But, you know, the question is, I mean, who are we really catching here, and who are we giving potential life sentences? Are we catching the people who are making it their business to sell drugs, or are we catching people who are addicts and selling as an incident to their addiction?
Well, and we should definitely talk about, you know, who is a drug dealer, who is someone who is struggling with a substance use disorder themselves. But I want to get your thoughts to Lieutenant Thomas, especially this idea of death resulting, you know, if someone does die from an overdose, the person who gave that fatal dose, you know, is treated like a second-degree murder.
Well, I agree with a lot that the folks have said. I disagree with some of it. You have to look at it a two-stage thing. Where you have the individual that's selling for clear profit, that is pumping the poison into the state, those individuals, you have to have the the book has to be thrown at them. All they're doing is spreading death and ill will to families. The user has to be treated differently. I do agree with that. I've seen it.
You have different programs.
Yeah. have different programs throughout the state, especially the Merrimack County is instituting the SOAR program, where they're working with the individuals before they come back out of jail. They're treating them in there. They're teaching these folks how to get back their lives back. You know, working, getting up, doing the daily tasks that we all take for granted. When you have that addiction, all those things become secondary. And I think Dean can probably, you know, talk about that. Those folks, we have to look at it differently. Law enforcement absolutely plays a role. As far as death resulting, if you do provide it, it's just like, I mean, the way I look at it, and I think law enforcement looks at it, is, you know, if you're providing the drug that kills that person, it's just as if you're sticking a knife in that person or you're shooting that person. You're ending a life. You knew what you were doing going into it. You knew the challenges going into it. The actual responsibility. Thank you. You know, so does it deter folks? I mean, I don't know if the statistics are out there. I would say if you're in that game, you got to know the rules. You got to know what you're dealing with, and you got to know the consequences. And you hit it right on the head. If you had a loved one, I mean, try sitting across from a loved one, which we have, and they, you know, and those cases are hard to prove. They're very hard. We put on a new protocol at our department where we have a drug death resulting. We have a protocol that we follow now. Because if it turns into a homicide case, we want the Attorney General's office to be able to come in and have a good, clean case. So,
how do you figure it out when you're on the scene, Lieutenant Thomas? You know, again, the person who's, you know, a high roller, clearly making money, this is their business, everybody agrees, you know, get that person off the streets. And then the person who's struggling with a substance use disorder and who overdoses or, you know, heaven forbid, dies, everyone feels compassion for that person. But there's this person in the middle who is, again, addicted themselves, but providing dangerous substances like fentanyl. How do you define that person? Are they a dealer? Are they an addict? How do you sort through that when you're on the scene?
Well, that's all going to come down to investigation. That's going to come down to knowing the people, the players that you're dealing with. I mean, majority of the time, if you're walking into a scene for a death resulting, it's more likely than not that's not going to be the big dealer's house. Okay, it might have been somebody, like Dean said, that's peddling it to support their own habit. You know, those are 90% of the things you're going to walk into.
90%?
Yeah, I would say that majority of a death resulting or a case that we walk into where we've been investigating for some dealing, the higher rollers, the dealers, I mean, those are the cases that you really got to put the time and effort into. And you got to be able to build the case to prove that they are your dealers and not the user per se.
I have a lot more questions for all of you, but let me invite our listeners to join us as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the role of punishment of law enforcement in combating the opioid addiction epidemic here in the Granite State. And let's hear from you. We'd love your thoughts, personal experiences. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Let's go to the phones, all of you. And Brett joins us from Manchester. Hi, Brett. You're on the exchange. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I was just calling because, I noticed that when I was an addict and I suffered from substance abuse disorder I've been clean for a little over a year now, almost a year and a half. And I was new to the area. I moved up here, and whenever I was in my active addiction, I was going down to Massachusetts to like Methuen, and I noticed that the dealer that I had, he was a young kid, and he wasn't a user. He was strictly just doing it to make money. But he eventually got caught, and I found this out after I got clean. But he got caught, and really just got kind of a slap on the wrist, and you know I got clean and had to really kind of start over my life. And in the process, I did end up getting a felony charge. And I just got put on probation. And now I'm finding myself having to completely start over again within a year because of this charge. And it's like, you know, me as the, you know, the person that's dealing with substance abuse disorder that's, you know, trying to get through it is getting the book thrown at me, whereas this kid who is strictly just making money, and it may be because he was a kid. I can't remember if he was 17 or 18, but I mean, he really just got kind of a slap on the wrist, and it was like, I want to say it was like a small misdemeanor and a fine, and that was it.
Wow. Well, Brett, thank you for calling, and congratulations on your recovery. And I'm sorry to hear about his whole life being turned upside down. What do you think, Attorney General Foster, about the story that Brett tells us?
You know, that's probably a deeper discussion where you have individuals who have beaten an addiction, and if they have a felony on their record, it can be difficult to find employment. And I know there's you know, general discussion sort of nationwide about what's the appropriate way to deal with folks to get them back on their feet. As to what happened to the dealer, I don't know whether that occurred in Massachusetts, whether the individual was a juvenile or not. There is also, I would say, unequal treatment even around our state, county to county, about how different judges view these crimes. It'd be nice to have a more uniform treatment, whatever that might be. There are always discussions around that, but each judge has their own view of what the appropriate sentence is, determining depending upon the facts.
Yeah, and each state is different. Go ahead, David.
I think Brett raises a really important point that I think we need to examine more carefully, and Lieutenant alluded to this. Brett, I don't know anything about Brett, obviously, or his situation, but I think people like Brett, assuming that they're addicts and they're not serious offenders, I think they need to be given a chance to try to avoid a felony conviction. That the SOAR program that the lieutenant is talking about, or the drug courts we have here in New Hampshire, all those people are already convicted generally of felonies. And then they go through the program. And I think it would be really valuable if we could take a person like Brett or a hypothetical person who is caught in the addiction. Yes, he has a felony charge. Can we take that person? Can we put him through some kind of a program before he goes through the court system and give him the opportunity to avoid the felony? Because as Attorney General Foster says, felony conviction, the disenfranchisement that one faces is huge. I can't imagine myself.
A bigger deal than a misdemeanor.
Correct.
Yeah. So because everybody wants to jump in. So Lieutenant Thomas and then Dean, go ahead.
So my understanding of the drug court that's coming to Merrimack County, which we're in the process of setting up, is that if they do complete the program, that the felony conviction will not stay. So they have that opportunity. If they complete the program that's put forth by the drug court, that charge will not be on their record. Wow. So that's the benefit of the drug court. But again, you're stuck in the middle where you got to figure out, and this falls on the court and the judge, like the Attorney General said, is you got to be able to figure out who's an actual addict and who's actually in this for profit.
Right, and that's what it's so hard to sort out.
And the judges are having hard times. I mean, we have actually heard phone calls, between inmates, because the phone calls are recorded during investigations, where they have actually telling each other, you know, go in and just tell them you're an addict. And this one individual was solely a dealer. Straight up dealer, wasn't a user, and he's going in there and he's pumping that into the court that, hey, I'm a user, I'm an addict, and so that's
you get
the
off lighter.
Well, he's trying. Correct. He's trying to, you know, go to the heart of the judge, and that's what we're seeing now, and that's what we, not just the courts and law enforcement, but we have to, as a group, look at this and try to figure how do you determine who's the actual dealer that doesn't deserve, who doesn't deserve getting that entitlement to go to drug court, and then where they're taking the time and space from the actual users.
All right, Dean, promise you get to jump in after a short break, and we'll take a lot more of your calls. Brett, thank you for that one. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Just because you binge-watched West Wing does not mean you understand how government works. And that is okay. NHPR's new podcast, Civics 101, reviews the fundamentals that you learned in school and then forgot. Like, what exactly does a chief of staff do?
Most presidents don't like firing people.
Subscribe to Civics 101 on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Schoolhouse Rock meets politics for grown-ups.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, where the criminal justice system, arrests, sweeps, and tough sentences fit in with combating New Hampshire's opioid crisis. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And we'd love your thoughts on this. What's the role of punishment in getting our arms around this opioid addiction problem we have here in the Granite State? Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have four guests with us in studio. Lieutenant John Thomas with the Concord Police Department is here. He's in charge of the Community Services Division. David Rothstein is with us, attorney with the New Hampshire Public Defender. Joe Foster is here. He's the Attorney General for the state. By the way, he's stepping down at the end of the month after 4 years. And Dean Lemire is with us. He's very active in statewide prevention, treatment, and recovery efforts. And Dean himself is in recovery from heroin addiction. And Dean, I did want to give you a chance to jump into our conversation just before the break, trying to figure out, again, who's, you know, again, the person we sympathize with, they're really having a hard time, and the person who's just in it for the profit.
Sure. Well, I wanted to congratulate and thank
Brett, our caller,
for calling in. You know, the more people kind of stand up and say, I'm a person in long-term recovery from specifically heroin, fentanyl addiction, really helps to change the public perception of, you know, is recovery possible? Is it worth investing in? And obviously it is. He kind of just casually said, I'm, you know, a year and a half clean from heroin. And, you know, that's news to a lot of people that that's possible. So thank you. And, you know, I just wanted to say, like, in my experience of working with people who are, you know, trying to recover mostly from an opioid or opiate addiction, the hardest cases, the hardest nuts to crack are people coming out of jails and prisons, who had, especially those who had a lengthier stay. Because what happens in jail or prison, unless you have a therapeutic community program like we have in Stratford County where I live, your identity changes. You become a criminal. It becomes part of your identity. You're less likely to be honest with people coming out because the culture within, you know, confinement is you're in survival mode. More often than not, there's a drug trade in prison, and you can be addicted throughout your stay in prison. And then if you have a felony conviction, like Brett alluded to, your recovery capital is severely diminished. Your ability to achieve and sustain any meaningful life apart from drugs and alcohol.
Hard to find a job, hard to get an apartment.
Almost impossible to find a job. You can go to the daily labor places, show up at 5:30 a.m., wait for a couple hours for maybe a job that is minimum wage.
And just for the day.
And really, those are loaded with people who are loaded, who are in the same boat. Ability to find housing. So we have a ton of couch surfers coming out of jail. There's just a huge misconnection between people exiting the criminal, justice realm and trying to reenter in society. So it's actually it's hugely damaging for somebody who really needs recovery. We're pushing people into the margins of society because they were in possession of a drug, which the line between possession and intent to sell, you know, it's very subjective.
Well, I want to ask Lieutenant Thomas about that in a minute. But you're sort of pushing back, Dean, against two images that we have. One is, well, if a person is arrested for using drugs, at least in prison or jail, they might have some attempt at recovery because we think they can't get the drugs behind bars, and that we have this image again that there are treatment programs, and sometimes there are and sometimes there aren't. So that's one image that's wrong, that locking someone up at least helps them stop the cycle.
Right. It doesn't make any sense. You're at, somebody who hasn't had the underlying causes of their addiction addressed, they're at acute risk of overdose and death when they get out. And correct me if I'm wrong, that's a lot of what we're seeing with people exiting jail is a few days later, they're caught right back up and they die because they're trying to use the same amount that they used before they went in, because nothing has changed except for time.
Right. And here's the other question that, and Lieutenant Thomas talked about this too. Again, you know, when you decide, okay, and you're saying it's bad to lock people up, it doesn't help them with their recovery. In fact, it makes it 10 times worse. But how are you from a law enforcement perspective going to figure out who is a person who really just needs help and who is the person who is effectively killing other people or ruining their lives through giving them drugs? How do you sort that out?
I don't think that it's for law enforcement to sort out. This is where you have communities that implement, law enforcement assisted diversion programs, you see incredible outcomes. You see fewer overdoses, diminished, crime related to the drug trade, people accessing health services. You're diverting somebody to, you know, a social worker or a recovery program where they should be, and absolutely circumventing, criminal justice. And this is also an argument about economics. When you spend money chasing down somebody for what could be a gram or less of, this killer drug, and then locking them up. I mean, what is the average cost between county and federal prison per person in New Hampshire? Is it about $35,000? That buys a lot of recovery. But locking somebody up for 5, 10, 20 years doesn't necessarily, it actually doesn't contribute to fewer deaths or fewer drugs coming across the border. And this is the strategy that we've had over the last 100 years. No other strategy has been funded. We don't have a good infrastructure for prevention, treatment, and recovery and harm reduction in the United States, and certainly not in New Hampshire, because all of this money is being diverted to law enforcement. There were 250,000 pounds of heroin alone that came from South America between Colombia and Mexico in 2014. 4,800 pounds were seized. So all of our money that could be going to prevention, treatment, harm reduction, recovery, it's going after a fraction of the deadly drug. And what happens is when you increase minimum sentences, you pretty much guarantee that the drug is going to raise in potency. This is probably why we have a fentanyl crisis rather than a marijuana crisis.
When you raise minimum sentences, you guarantee that, and I'm going to get everybody else in on this because you're raising a lot of important points, Dean. When you raise minimum sentences, you increase drug potency out on the street?
So when the risk is raised, for peddling these drugs, whether you're organized crime like the El Chapos of the world, the drug cartels, or you're the small-time dealer, when the risk is raised, it makes more sense to have a more potent product that you can hide more easily. A smaller amount by volume packs a bigger punch. You can.
Well, hearing Dean talk, Attorney General Foster, about, we've had this approach forever, the war on drugs, so to speak. President Nixon, declared the war on drugs in the 70s, and then Ronald Reagan continued it, and then Bill Clinton continued it. But just in the past year or two, there's been more sort of bipartisan discussion that we've gone way overboard. A lot of talk in the election about mass incarceration from candidates from both sides. What do you think? Are we going down the wrong path here with Granite Hammer and, other types of programs like this, efforts that we've made in the past that Dean says really didn't work? We're still dealing with people struggling with drugs.
I mean, a good deal of what Dean says, I agree with in a general way. That law enforcement will say you can't arrest your way out of the problem. You started the show with that statement, and it's absolutely true. The place you got to, I said, there's supply and there's the demand side, and what Dean somewhat is talking about is the demand side. The state has done a lot around that in the last legislative session. It's putting a lot more dollars into treatment and recovery. Medicaid expansion, by the way, is super important because it has a substance abuse and mental health benefit. Hopefully, whatever happens in Washington, we'll still have that benefit coming to New Hampshire because it's critical to our system of treatment and recovery. The other place that I think what makes this particular epidemic a little different than the ones you were talking about is it's at least my belief that the a lot of the heroin and the now fentanyl addiction, 80% of those people start on prescription pills. And so the legislature also, as you know, has now made the prescription drug monitoring program mandatory. It adopted opiate prescribing rules. Our office actually was very involved in both of those initiatives because
and New Hampshire was late to the game on that, by the way.
It was late to the game, particularly with both. James Varro, who's now I sometimes referred to it as a drug czar. I don't know what his actual title is. He worked with me hand in hand on trying to get those opiate prescribing rules as well as prescription drug monitoring program through the legislature because we have to stop creating new addicts. Sadly, with the pills, when we have drug takebacks, there's millions and millions of pills that are turned in, many of which are opiates.
What do you think, David? Are we heading back for another 70s, 80s war on drugs?
Well, I don't think it's – I mean, it's a tough question to answer, obviously. But one thing that is happening, when Dean talks about the economics, we have – coming up, Senate Bill 131, which appropriates $2.1 million to hire 15 new state troopers specifically for drug interdiction. And the state police estimates that each of those troopers is going to make 4 arrests per week. So if you do the math, we're going to put if this goes through, we're going to put another 3,120 cases out there per year. Those are cases that are going to come in as a result of the work of these 15 troopers. That cost is $2.1 million. It doesn't include the cost to handle the additional prosecution, the additional defense, the additional cost of processing these cases through the court personnel, judges to hear the case. And then what we've been talking about a lot is, all right, now we've spent $2.1 million, plus we've spent the additional money, which is hard to calculate, to prosecute and defend and adjudicate.
And incarcerate,
and now,
which is
well,
also
that's
a lot of
that's
money.
That's the other question. What is happening to Joe or Jane defendant who's potentially had a gram of heroin, who is not a member of the Sinaloa cartel, who is not hiding a kilo 100 fingers of heroin in his or her trunk? How many? I mean, I don't think anyone can argue that if we get a person like that, and I don't think Dean would argue that if we get a person like that, they should not be punished very severely, even if they have an addiction problem. But what are we going to do with those people? Are we going to develop these types of diversion programs that we're talking about and put some funding into those types of programs so that these people don't all become the types of felons that Dean's talking about? Or are we going to put them all in jail and have them come out of jail and have them cycle through the same process and be arrested by one of these same 15 troopers a year or two down the road?
So would you say, David, instead of, hey, Governor Sununu, instead of spending $2 million more on state troopers to arrest more people, take that money and, mandate drug treatment, bring people into court, but mandate that their sentence, quote unquote, is drug treatment, and that's a better way to do it?
Well, I mean, again, it's not, I mean, of these 3,000 people, let's just say there are 3,000 people, they're all arrested hypothetically for having a small amount of heroin. Some of the people, if you look at them as individuals, because of their prior criminal record or prior chances they've been given, maybe just getting more drug treatment isn't the answer. Many of those people, however, should not be treated as felons, probably. I mean, in terms, and then, the cost of branding somebody as a felon, you put them back out in a society, and their marketability is totally shot. We as a society are going to end up supporting them because they can't support themselves. They're going to be on, more likely to be on some sort of, social service that we have to support because they can't stand on their feet, because they can't support their families, because they can't get a decent job.
So, again, putting myself, in the position of being a mom, okay?
Sure.
So I have 2 sons. Most people who listen to this show know that. So if someone gave one of my sons heroin or fentanyl and he was harmed, died, became addicted, life became extremely difficult, like Brett, our
sure.
caller, I personally, as a mom, would want that person to pay a price beyond getting some nice addiction treatment. program.
Well, you know, and again, I mean, if some of these people that are being caught are dealers, you know, like Lieutenant Thomas talks about, or Attorney General Foster talks about, if they are truly dealers and they're dealing for profit.
But even if they weren't dealers, even if they just gave one of my sons a drug that harm them.
But that's
I would be pretty upset and would want that person to pay a price.
Right. Sure. With all due respect, your son is an addict and your son needs help.
Got it. Nobody forced him to take that.
Yeah. And again, I mean, I feel that the article that Paige Sutherland did has a picture of the mom whose son died in the Laconia case, the Watson case. And you can see the pictures of her son with the puppy. I mean, they're crushing. But you know, just to say, you know, you gave heroin out to somebody, I am going to punish you really severely. I just think we have to ask if that's sort of a knee-jerk response that is appropriate.
Right. What's going on with the person who accepted it? I hear you. And we haven't heard from you in a while, Lieutenant Thomas. So go ahead.
So what Dave's saying, and he can attest to this, but I mean, from my experiences over the years, it's very rare for someone who got caught with, you know, small amount of heroin ends up actually with the felony conviction. Usually gets pled down, no jail time. It's very rare you're going to see somebody that gets, you know, first time they get caught with possession of heroin or any felony level drug, that they're going to actually end up in jail or prison. It's, you know, the person that's carrying, that's coming back from Massachusetts and you know, is majority of the time is stopped on 93 by a trooper or, you know, one of the major roads that has a large amount of heroin or fentanyl or some other felony carrying level drug. Those are the individuals that will end up with the charge on their record, end up possibly doing some prison time. Now, the person like who's the addict, who's got multiple charges of possession, and this is where I think the state is finally starting to see the light. Is that, okay, we're not changing things by arresting this individual and trying to, you know, get him into jail or forcing him into prison. Those are the folks that do need the help, that are actually will tell you that, listen, I need the help. And those are the folks that I agree with what Dean was saying earlier. Those are the folks we got to focus on and try to get them, because just throwing them behind the wall and them coming out with no assistance, no treatment inside, no trying to get them back on the right track. Those are the individuals that we're setting them up for failure.
Like Dean said, we're kidding ourselves.
Correct, and I agree with that. But at the same time, we got to recognize that we're behind the eight ball here in the state. We're late to the game. Things that are happening that we're trying to get done now, we probably should have been working on this 2 to 3 years ago.
Like what, Lieutenant Thomas? What are we late
to the game
on? I
think like with the sewer program, Merrimack County is just starting to get that going. The actual drug court, you got a couple counties that have it rolling out. We haven't rolled ours out yet. We're trying to get that going. But these are things that probably should have done. We should have been looking at 2-3 years ago, trying to get that ball rolling.
Is that basically sentencing someone to drug treatment? Is that what that
Correct.
Is?
Correct. Yes. You're giving them an option other than having the charge fall on their record. They have the ability to go through the drug court if they qualify for that. And it's not easy. There's demands that they have to meet to pass that, you know, what the judge has set forth during the drug court. So those are the things that I see happening. But the other thing that Dean touched on that we didn't talk about is that New England as a whole was targeted by the Mexican cartel, and that's why we have the fentanyl problem. It was targeted. This just didn't happen by accident. They knew, for whatever reason, New England as a whole had an opiate problem.
Got to cut you off there, Lieutenant. We will pick up after a short break.
Just because you binge-watched West Wing does not mean you understand how government works. And that is okay. NHBR's new podcast, Civics 101, reviews the fundamentals that you learned in school and then forgot. Like, what exactly does a chief of staff do?
Most presidents don't like firing people.
Subscribe to Civics 101 on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's Schoolhouse Rock meets politics for grown-ups.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the law enforcement and supply side of New Hampshire's drug epidemic. The Exchange number, 1-800 892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. And Richard's in Farmington. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Morning.
I lost my daughter to fentanyl July of 2015. And I'm listening to these people talk about sentencing. You know, as someone who lost a child, even though she was 40, she's still my child.
And absolutely.
I'm a 17-year-old and a 10-year-old. You know, I want the son of a bitch in jail. You know, this is crazy. Whether he is the first dealer, the second dealer, the third dealer, everyone that passes it on is equally as responsible for her death.
I am so sorry, Richard, about your daughter. It's just the worst pain that anyone can imagine. Did she get treatment at all, Richard, or did this come as a surprise?
We struggled with this for over 5 years.
Yeah.
There was no treatment. And what treatment was available was 30-day ridiculous. 30 days does nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. It's just the idea that, you know, she had been straight for about 2 years, moved into HUD housing in which dealers were living, which also is not supposed to happen. And, you know, she didn't stand a chance.
Richard,
she struggled so much.
I'm so sorry for your loss again. And thank you for, you know, telling that story on the air, because I'm sure that's not easy. David, I want to ask you about that. He lost his daughter and he doesn't care where that person was on the, you know, on the spectrum of whatever struggles they may have. He wants that person in jail.
Nor should he. I mean, I totally understand how he feels, and he has every right to feel the way he feels about what should happen to the person. I don't know. We don't know from the call if there was a prosecution or if anything did happen to a particular person. And he has a voice in the system. I mean, obviously, in any case that's prosecuted, he has a voice, and his opinion is taken into account by prosecutors and by police when they try to come up with appropriate sentences. But there are obviously good reasons why, you know, in our criminal justice system, there are a number of factors that are considered, one of which is how the victim's family feels, others of which are, you know, are bigger and just difficult questions that that we're still grappling with. And obviously, a couple of the things that Richard says really resonate with the struggle that he had with his daughter, the fact that the treatment that was made available to her was wholly inadequate. If you're a heroin addict, and I'm sure Dean can comment better than any of us on this, a 30-day program where you're thrown back out into HUD housing to be surrounded by other people who are heroin addicts is not going to get the job done, and it's going to be a setup for a tragedy like this. So I absolutely feel for him. He's absolutely entitled to be angry. But we also have to continue to look at listen to some of the other things he said about how this whole situation arose.
Attorney General Foster, you looked like you wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, you know, when we were ramping up this program, you look at each case
when you
separately.
Say this program, just remind us what you mean.
Prosecuting the death resulting cases.
So again, prosecuting someone who handed over that deadly drug.
Like the story we just heard. I think we feel that a person ought to be held responsible, much like a drunk driver is, where they cause a death when they're driving, whether there was intent there or not. They do know what they're doing. They know they're selling the poison. As David mentioned, you can be held up to life, but there's no minimum. And when sentencing it takes place, the judge will look, is this person a drug dealer? Were they dealing as their business of choice? Were they a significant dealer? We've had cases where individuals have dealt, a death has occurred, and before they're brought to be held responsible, they're dealing again. All those things are going to be taken into account in sentencing. So there is flexibility in the system to treat individuals who commit this act, either very severely or not so severely, depending on their circumstances.
Well, we got an email from Keith who raises a similar point. He says, regarding treating those who sell heroin as a way to support their own addiction versus those who sell heroin as a deliberate livelihood, it raises a difficult question on if addicts should be looked at differently in the eyes of the law. Keith says, alcoholics are also addicts, but does that mean a drunk driver who causes a fatality should be treated differently if they are an alcoholic and acting in the throes of their addiction? What do you think, Dean?
Richard, I'm so sorry for your loss. I've lost childhood friends, you know, certainly since entering recovery. I have a network of peers who some of them drop off, you know, some of them die, and it becomes part of the expectation. It's just, at some point I have to become a little bit numb to it, you know, because it's so common. You know, we are in a war. This is a war, and it's chaos. And I understand the impulse to want to exact justice for one instance in which somebody died in a war. I get that. I have a 3-year-old daughter. If somebody knowingly gave her a poison that ended up killing her, I would want to mete out that justice myself. You know, that would be my reaction. But if we're looking at this as a strategy to create better outcomes, we have to look at it differently.
Broader success.
Right. If we're trying to, you know, is it unacceptable to us that there is a drug trade, or is it unacceptable to us that people are dying? You know, and it really, from my lens, it really is a choice between the two in terms of developing a meaningful strategy. Do we focus on the justice of, going after the people who ostensibly killed one person with, you know, by handing over a drug, or do we kind of take a 30,000-foot view and really try to change course from what we've been doing for the last 100 years?
What do you all think about the resource issue? And I know this sort of came up a little bit earlier. I think David brought it up, the idea that, you know, programs like More Troopers on the Road and Granite Hammer and so forth are being greater funded. And then there are people like, you know, Dean and David, I'll turn to you, Lieutenant Thomas, who say, yeah, okay, but this would buy a lot of treatment. I just wonder what you think.
Well, you got to understand, too, is a lot of the push towards somebody wanting to take that first step to treatment. And I can only attest to my, you know, my experiences over the 23 years on the job, is that I have had majority of the folks that end up clean, like Dean did, it started with being arrested. They said, you saved my life. You know, I would never have started down this path. My family couldn't get me to do it. My loved ones couldn't get me to do it. But the being arrested and being put in front of that judge and having that hang over my head that I'm going to end up in prison or I'm going to end up dead, that pushed me to start down the road of recovery. I've heard those stories multiple times. So there has to be a starting point, and that's, you know, I think that's where law enforcement plays the role. But like I said before, you do have that balancing act. You got to be able to, you got to have those programs. And unfortunately, over the past years, the state made multiple cuts in that area where the money wasn't available. But I think we're starting to get our feet under us as a state, and we've recognized it, and they're trying to correct it. But I'm totally in support of the programs. Like we're currently working with Hope New Hampshire, who this past year opened up an office here in town, which has been outstanding for
us. Not far from here,
actually.
Yep,
to reach out to them for their assistance. But again, you got programs like that do struggle with funds also. It's always a money issue, but at the same time, you still need the law enforcement element involved in this, because if you don't have that, I don't think you're going to have a good starting point to help folks down that recovery.
And I have heard people say, when the blue lights flash, you know, that was the moment where I realized, okay, I need to stop this. But you also agreed with Dean that a lot of folks, you know, we think, oh, at least they're in jail, they're not using anymore. You know, that's a good point. You also felt like, yeah, that's that's we're kind of kidding ourselves. No, if we think that...
absolutely. And Dean's right when he talks about drugs behind the bar, behind bars, behind the walls. That's absolutely correct. Just because they're behind the wall doesn't mean they're not getting their daily fix or daily dose of drugs.
Let's take another call. This is Peter in Plymouth. Hi, Peter. You're on the air. Welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Sure.
So I'm just a little bit confused because if we're going to talk about the stealing and talk about the repetitive problem, we have to spend more money figuring out what's going on in the prison. Last year, a food worker in Berlin was caught with $70,000 worth of drugs going into the prison. You can't find the news story. You can't find the court hearing. You can't find the sentencing online. This wasn't somebody paid by a prisoner to bring these drugs in. So obviously there's a much larger problem with the drug dealing in the state, spanning multiple levels, whether it goes into law enforcement or out of law enforcement. It's sometimes very hard to tell. And almost every addict in recovery is a dealer because most of them are getting their Suboxone and then selling their Suboxone so that they can buy the heroin that they want. And as a business owner, I've seen it over and over. I've been through the struggle with employees. We have an open relationship about it. And for somebody like me, it's incredibly frustrating to see the massive deficiencies in the entire system.
Sure. Well, and Peter, thank you for calling in. And we could probably talk for another 20 minutes on how drugs are actually getting into the prisons and jails, because as you've pointed out, Dean, you know, that's a big problem. But we'll set it aside for now in the interest of time. Here's an email from Sheila, who says, it's not as simple as either addict or kingpin. The young man who is dealing for money only has a story, too. He could have, probably was, set up and controlled by someone else. It's a whole network, and the guys at the top figure out ways to protect themselves, sometimes by bribing or worse. She says the problem is multi-level, and so the approach needs to be as well. Sheila, thank you for that one. Jeffrey also says, well, I don't disagree with charging someone who supplied the drugs that resulted in overdose and death. As a taxpayer, I think we could better spend our money than by dishing out lengthy prison sentences for these people. You said there's no difference between this crime and murder, but there is a difference in which that the person who died willingly took those drugs. They were not forced. Jeffrey says, I am not convinced that this policy will actually help solve any of the drug problems that society faces. And Jeffrey, thank you for that one. Dean, what do you think about Jeffrey's point? The person who died willingly took those drugs. They were not forced. Willingly is kind of a tough word when you're really having a hard time with a substance abuse
right,
disorder.
And that's what makes, you know, the topic of addiction so strange when compared to, you know, other health conditions, because there is this element of choice that uninformed people believe exists when addiction is in full force. So
it's not like, do you want an ice cream cone or not?
Exactly. It's not right. So I mentioned I have a 3-year-old daughter, and we got a rescue cat. His name at the shelter was Barnacle Bill. We decided to dignify him with the name Lenny, and our daughter is like obsessed with Lenny. Loves Lenny. We all love Lenny, but you know, our daughter really loves Lenny. And so I'll pick her up from daycare, take her home, and she'll say, where's Lenny? She'll go and chase Lenny, find him under the bed where he's hiding from her specifically, and drag him out by a paw, and then practically strangle him. And I hope that there, you know, no PETA listeners are going to come after me, but we do our best to limit the harm of this, but you know, so then, you know, I try to separate those two. I try to inform our daughter that she's hurting the cat, that this is a rule, you're not allowed to do that. You know, these are the consequences if you don't put Lenny down right now.
But she's 3 and she can't resist him. Because he's adorable and furry.
Right.
And that's the point that you're trying to
is
make.
That, right. Well, what I see is like a really strange obsession, you know. You know, our daughter does not like the situation that she's in when she's got two parents yelling at her you know, making threats and stuff like that. She does not like the situation, but she just can't. She literally cannot let go of Lenny. And that, you know, so
I think I get the analogy that you're making. This idea of choice willingly took, maybe yes.
So in my own experience, in my own addiction, like I would never have made the choices that I did if I were well, right? If I were mentally well, and if I had some supports in my life, like you know, some treatment from some maybe early childhood trauma. You know, a network of peers who I could rely on. There's just so many things that could, you know, interventions that could have been in place before I got into that situation where I was chemically and psychologically dependent on a drug.
Well, Jeffrey, thank you for the email. And Attorney General Foster just came out this week. You're leaving at the end of the month. When it comes to this very tough problem that we're talking about today of opioid addiction, what's your advice for your successor?
I think it's a complicated problem. It's public health, public safety. As I've said, you got to be fighting it on the supply side, but you got to be pushing on the demand side too. And I think there's a role for whoever the next attorney general is to look on both sides. And what I mean by that is I continue some of these law enforcement initiatives, but also be looking for prevention dollars, treatment dollars, recovery dollars, and making sure that the folks don't start on prescription pills and try to continue the efforts that I've made in that arena as well.
And real quick, you were a state senator for 6 years, now attorney general for 4 years. What's next?
Don't know yet. Don't know yet. I think I have a month off, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, all of you, thank you so much for helping us wade through this tough subject, and I really appreciate everybody being here. Thank you.
Laura, I'd like to thank you for bringing this, you know, out, because it is a war, and thank you for you
thank
doing
you.
This.
You're welcome.
Thank
all
you.
Right. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.